Hey guys, we're back! It's your editor, LT from Yanko Design. First off, I'm so sorry it took so long to get this episode up. This is episode 4, by the way. The interview with designer extraordinaire James Owen. It's been months since we posted something, and again, I'm sorry, there was just some technical glitches that I finally got figured out. But before I jump in the interview with James, I want to go over some news items. First is we have a store now. If you didn't know, we have a store where you can buy a lot of the products that we talk about on the site. You can look it up at store.yankodesign.com. We always get emails from people saying, where can I buy it? Where can I buy it? And you just got to understand, Yanko Design is, for the most part, a concept blog featuring concept designs in the industrial design community, sometimes automotive, sometimes architectural. But every now and then, we do come across products sort of like on the threshold of concept and production. And when they do move into production and we like it, then we try to get it in the store. So check out the store, store.yankodesign.com. If you don't see anything you like now, keep coming back because we're always adding stuff to it. Next on my list is to welcome back Anthony James, one of our writers who was on hiatus for a long time, but he's back. Not back full time, but he's writing. I know a lot of you guys like his writing style a lot. So he's back. Say, you know, shout out to him. Look him up on Facebook or whatever. Hi, Anthony. And the other thing is I just wanted to say hi to Rahika, our executive assistant, whom went to Japan and finally met the owner of Yanko Design, Takashi Yamada. And what people don't realize about Yanko Design is we're not so much everyone sitting in a huge office somewhere in a central location. We're all over the world. A lot of people working from home. A lot of people are treating this as their second jobs. They're just really doing it, you know, out of love for design. And Rahika is one of those people. She's actually based in India. And I'm in Los Angeles. Takashi's in Japan. Sometimes he's in Vancouver. Jason's in Vancouver. Nancy is in Vancouver. Anthony is in LA. Chris, I don't know where you're at. You're in Minnesota? So, but you know, we're all over the place. And it's really a wonder that we're able to all work together and get this going and sort of have it work. And that's really all thanks to mostly Takashi and Rahika, who sort of keep everything going. So thanks again, and I'm finally you guys, glad that you guys finally met. So, and I got an email, y'all. I got an email on episode 3, and I'm just now going to answer the question. So the question is, where do you get all these cool ideas from? And the answer is from you guys. We ask you guys to submit your designs. It didn't matter if you're a professional, doesn't matter if you're a student, doesn't matter if you're an amateur. If you have something and you submit it to us and we like it, we'll write about it, we'll post it, and hopefully get some attention for you. And that's really it. You know, if it's not you guys sending us projects, you know, a lot of our writers are actually out there putting feelers out, looking for projects. You know, we go to schools, we go to independent companies and try to find out what their latest projects are. So that's really how we get all the ideas for our posts. So anyways, like I said, this is episode 4, interview with James Owen. Now, you may remember him for his products, which, duh, is what you remember most designers for, right? So one of his products that you may be familiar with is his Leo scratching post, which is amazing cat scratching post. That's like, I don't know, I forget, I think it's made of like zebra wood or something. Don't quote me on that because he talks about it. We talk about it extensively in the interview. But it sits on like a metal base that's weighted, and the post doesn't ever collapse because it's weighted in a way where it always sort of bounces back up upright. Anyways, so we wrote about it on the blog. So if you look up Leo scratching post, you probably will find it on our site. And the other thing that he worked on that you may recognize is something I reviewed is the Quickback bike rack for Yakima, which is, I think, a pretty recent review. It's only been about a few months. So check that out. Anyway, so I've been meaning to to speak with James for a long, long, long time because we're big fans of his and we consider him like extended family in Anchor Design. So, yeah. Take it away, James.
This is James.
Hi, James. It's Long from Yanko Design.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Do you have a minute to speak now?
Oh, for sure.
Okay, cool. I'm so glad I finally get the chance to talk to you. I think I've known of you for like almost over a year or 2 years now.
Oh, okay.
Since the, the cat scratching post was the first time yep. that I heard of you, and we wrote about that. And I knew I remembered your name again when the quick back came across my desk. I was like, wait, I know James from somewhere. I got to look into this.
Well, I definitely appreciate that. And yeah, the cat scratching post is still a labor of love. We're still trying to get that made.
Oh, really? What happened?
Well, so, you know, the original manufacturing arrangement fell through with Design Within Reach. So, you know, we've been through a couple of rounds of talking with manufacturers, talking with middlemen who could get it manufactured, and even talking with like small boutique resellers and retailers who are interested in licensing it. Mm-hmm. But those all kind of met dead ends. And, you know, right now, again, we're talking with, we're talking about a licensing agreement with a company in, I think they're in Austria, to try to get it manufactured. So, you know, it's definitely one of those products that's not easy to manufacture. It would be, you know, fairly low quantity for a high price.
Right.
And it takes, you know, a certain level of execution to get it to come out right and to kind of deliver on the promise of the prototype that, you know, we photographed and sent out to people. So to meet all those criteria, it's, you know, it requires a very particular and special kind of relationship. Right. And we're still trying to secure that relationship. So
the pictures on your website, that's an actual model. It's not a render, right?
Yeah. So it was a prototype that we built on spec for this, you know, for DWR.
Yeah. And
when that kind of failed, that prototype sitting in my living room.
Do you have a cat?
Yeah, actually, my wife kind of convinced me to get a cat. and that was kind of the impetus for the whole thing. Uh-huh. So, you know, the cats kind of got us in a lot of trouble.
So I'm curious, are you a cat lover, or, I mean, what made you go one day, you know, into yourself, just think, I'm going to make a cat scratching post?
Well, I wasn't originally a cat lover. It was my wife who wanted to get a cat, and I couldn't see any reason why not. So, you know, once we had a pet in the house, then I realized that there were a bunch of opportunities to improve on, you know, not only pet accessories, but cat furniture and cat accessories in particular. Because most of the stuff that's out there is crap. I mean,
it's hideous.
It's really horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's horrible stuff. So, I mean, if you just walk down the aisle of, like, Petco or the pet aisles at any major big box chain, or if you scroll through many of the catalogs that sell pet accessories and cat stuff, it's all really cheap, nasty products that really aren't built to last very long. And it's too bad because, you know, cats live to 18, 20 years old, and dogs can live to 12, 15 years old. So you figure you're kind of making an investment in some of that stuff. And
right.
So after taking a look around at that and just looking for really obvious things that could be improved, the cat scratching post was like the most obvious product that could be improved. I mean, there are a couple of other designerly cat scratching posts out there, but I didn't feel like they were quite fitting the bill.
Right.
So I just, for this DWR assignment, that's what I did. I mean, it was just super simple, you know, see if you can get something that's for the modern upscale, you know, cat lover.
Right. So does your cat like it? Does he or she use it?
Well, she actually doesn't have front claws.
Oh.
So she can't use it. she that's still kind of goes through the motion. Sorry, go ahead.
That's not the cat in the photos, is it? Well, there's two cats.
No, those cats actually, I had to hire a cat wrangler for that photo session.
cute.
And there is such a thing. There is a cat wrangler. And they bring their own cats that are trained to pose for photos and are very well behaved. I mean, our cat would never...
Right.
Would never sit still for that. There's just no way you could photograph her doing that stuff.
Right.
So cat wranglers hired, you know, photo studio rented, and get them all together, and, you know, you've got a full day of photo shooting. So she kind of goes through the motion of scratching things.
Yeah.
But it's very rare because she doesn't have claws anymore. But the interesting thing about cat posts, and what most people don't realize, is that you actually have to train your cat to use a cat scratching post. They won't just use it automatically. They have to be trained to use it. Or whatever you want them to scratch on, they have to be trained to use that. And I think a lot of people have the misconception that cats will just naturally go to the proper thing that they're supposed to scratch, and they won't. They have to be trained. And I mean, obviously online, there's tons of clinical studies that say, yes, this is what you have to do. You have to train them for several weeks or several months, and then they finally will get it, and then they'll go to that and not scratch up your sofa or scratch up your hope chest or, right, you know, scratch up your fireplace, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Tell me, I'm reading the little description about, I know I keep harping and staying on the scratching post, but it's still, yep, like the most beautiful. Like, if I bought this, I probably wouldn't even let my cat touch it if I had a cat. Because it's just, it's way too pretty. Like, it would just look good just standing there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I really appreciate that, guys. That's actually, that's high praise. I mean, that makes me feel really good because I feel like I've kind of solved the problem.
Yeah.
And maybe it solved it too well to a degree. So I really appreciate that. And actually, I've been very surprised at how positive a reaction I've gotten to this cat scratching post. I mean, I've got a folder full of emails from individuals,
yeah,
who want to buy it. These are just people that have cats and they want to buy one.
Right.
And a certain percentage of those, they want to buy it just because it's very sculptural, which surprised me. I got, you know, several people who said, hey, this is just like a beautiful object, and I would just like to have it, as you're saying, as an object in your living room.
Right.
And that kind of caught me off guard because I hadn't really thought of it as an art object before or a sculpture. I think some people looked at it and said, hey, that's just sculpture. It goes beyond a functional cat scratching post to just being what it is, an object.
Right.
So that's very interesting. That's never actually happened before on any other thing that I've worked on. And I think it kind of connects back to what you were saying is you just want to have it in your living room. It's an interesting looking object.
There's something about it that, I don't know. I look at it and it's organic and it's kind of futuristic, but there's not really a specific time period or era that you could necessarily say it belongs to. And the fact that it looks artful, but the fact that it's functional, it has a real world use and it's for a pet kind of makes it endearing. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
And then just looking at it and it's zebra wood, right? And you've done something different with the grain. I'm sure zebra wood doesn't naturally come out looking like that. But
well, so actually, what's happening there is that in order to make this, not economically, but to make it feasibly producible,
right?
And we learned this making the prototype is that you can't just take a block of wood and lay it down.
Right.
You have to take a board of wood and cut it into sections, laminate it together, and then lay it down like a baseball bat. That's why the wood looks the way that it does, the pattern looks the way that it does. And this was actually a surprise. We didn't expect this to happen, and it was just a function of being able to make it economically,
right,
which is to buy a board length of material and then laminate it together and cut it out, and that causes the pattern of the wood to kind of striate.
Yeah. It worked. It worked. It definitely elevates the whole thing to, like, another level. Like, it looks so intentional. It looks sort of like some kind of math genius went in and, like just created all that, because it looks really difficult to make, even though you're saying it's an easier way to make that form.
Oh, it's the most basic, dumb way to make, a large piece of wood or, a large construction of wood that you can do, because you're just cutting board down, gluing it together, and then cutting it out. I mean, it's very, very basic.
Yeah. And the reason why I really want to talk to you about the Yakima pickback, the reason why I went back to the cat is because I think last week one of the writers put up like a top 10 post of products for pets, and I got like a bunch of emails saying, why are 9 out of the 10 things for dogs? What about cats? And so I was like, wait, I know we talked about some cat things before, and you're right. I started doing some research into cat stuff, and compared to the designery stuff for dogs, the stuff for cats is like terrible. So that's why I kind of like, wait, I know there's a scratching post. I know it's somehow related to James. I need to look back in my emails and go to his website, and there it is, the cat post. And what is it called? Does it have a name?
Leo. Leo cat scratching post.
Who's Leo?
Yeah, Leo is just the astrological sign for the cat.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So, not trying to be too on the nose, but obviously it's still semi-literal to relating to felines and cats.
Yeah, right.
And simple. It's a name that's easy to remember. Leo is pretty simple. I actually went to ICFF about 3 years ago, and, I was pretty disappointed with what I saw in terms of cat accessories. There weren't even really that many dog accessories there, but there were more well thought through dog accessories than cat accessories.
Right.
And even that stuff was kind of like prettied up products that kind of already exist.
Right.
And when I say that, I mean it's just like stuff that's screwed to the wall with cardboard on it or something.
Right.
I think the cat accessory market is lagging behind the dog accessory market, because I think for some reason manufacturers just give more attention to dogs, which is weird because there's actually more cats in the country than there are, well, in the U.S.
Right, and I was just going to say that. They outnumber the dogs significantly.
Yes.
And most cat owners, when they have, I think I read somewhere that people usually have more than one cat in one household, so, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that market is pretty ripe. I think there's a lot of opportunity in those markets. Mm-hmm. They're just not being exploited, and it's very hard to get major manufacturers interested in exploiting it, especially from a higher level of design and functionality.
Right.
Because their mentality is still make it as cheap as possible, as fast as possible, and get it on the market because nobody cares.
Right.
And I don't think that's – I think the dog lovers have proved that that's not true.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, and I think cat people dote on their cats as much as, dog people dote on their dogs, and maybe more so in some ways, because maybe cats are seen as a little bit more defenseless. it's been kind of frustrating dealing with the fabrication and production issues of this product. I mean, I'm still positive and hopeful that someday we will get this onto the market in some limited quantity. This will probably never be a mass market product.
Right.
Or if there is a mass market version of it, it won't have the aluminum base. It might be some other iteration.
Right.
But this particular version, I still feel confident that we can find a retailer or manufacturer that can get this on the market for about $200 to $300, and we could probably sell several thousand of them.
See, I think that's totally feasible, because when you were just about to say, when you kind of said two and kind of paused, I was getting ready for you to say 2,000. And I would have accepted that. Because it looks like a $2,000, like, art, you know, piece of furniture or something like that. But 200, 300, I know tons of cat owners that are fanatical about buying the best things for their animals, and they would totally buy that.
For sure. I agree with you. I think that there definitely is at the very high end. Yeah. There's people that would pay that kind of money. Unfortunately, I think that market's very small, and it's almost too small even for a boutique object.
Yeah.
So I think the narrow path that you'd have to go down with something like this is hitting a price point that's obviously way out of line for Petco, but is still within reason for all the boutique retailers that sell, you know, a couple hundred of these a year or every 6 months. And you have to get 10 or 20 of those boutique retailers signed up to sell it so that you can at least break even. And that means selling it at a price point that is still, you know, much higher than most other products, but it's still feasible. It's still attainable by more people who, even middle-class people, say, you know what, okay, it's $300, but you know what, we'll probably only buy it one of those for the rest of the cat's life. So right. It's worth it because it looks more durable than those, you know, those logs that are nailed to a piece of plywood.
Totally.
So I think it's a very tricky marketing strategy and path and channel that you have to sell through with this kind of product. It's really tricky. It's much trickier than I thought initially. Mm-hmm. Because this product is kind of specialized, and it's not a chair, it's not an ottoman, it's not like a special pen or toothbrush. Mm-hmm. It's kind of different, and it's kind of something that's not been done yet, and people still don't quite understand it. You know, some people get it, some people don't. Mm-hmm. So it's just a cat scratching post. That's the most frustrating thing. It's like, it's not rocket science. We're not trying to, you know, reinvent anything here. It's just a cat scratching post. That's all that it is. But, you know, some people still have a hard time with it. Although I will say that, you know, some of the initial bomb estimates that we got for this post, you know, are about $50 or $60, which is pretty good. So I think we could sell it for $250.
Yeah.
Theoretically, I think you can do it.
Totally.
So, but that's, you know, that's getting made in India or China.
Right. So, but when it does come to market, you have to tell me, because I'll buy one. And I don't have a cat, but I'll just buy one just because. I mean, it wobbles and uprights itself, right?
Well, so for a production, I think we have to take the wobble feature out of the initial run.
The reason
that we have to take it out is that cats like stable posts to scratch on.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so that's something
that freaked them out if it started moving on its own, bouncing back.
Yeah, they won't use it. So through research with the prototype, we found out that. And the reason that all cat scratching posts are stable is
right.
Because if it moves around, they won't use it because it's not stable. They can't get – what they need to do is they need to be able to reach up, get their claws in, and pull down.
Right.
And that pulling isn't evenly distributed around the post. So if the post rocks or moves like this, the prototype did –
Yeah.
Then it freaks them out and they won't use it. So, you know, the first version that's going to be out, if we can get it made, is a stabilized version, which is what cats prefer.
Right. But will it still have the rounded base at the bottom? Are you just adding like a lot of weight to it to keep it stabilized, or?
No, we're actually just flattening it slightly on the bottom.
I see.
You can't really see it unless you look at it on a pure side view.
Right.
It's basically just like cutting out a section of that oval on the bottom to make it stable so that the design is still there. It's just that it doesn't rock anymore. And that's kind of critical because if we sell it as a cat scratching post, then it has to function to a degree as a cat scratching post.
Uh-huh.
So we can't really have it wobble. Now, that's not to say that there won't be a wobbling version somewhere down the road, but in this particular case, you know,
for cat owners.
For cat owners who want to train their cats to use it, it's got to be stable. It has to, because cats won't use it if it's not.
Gotcha.
So, that's the, you know, pitfalls of learning through prototypes.
Totally. So, by the way, if you, James, I'm actually recording you for our podcast, so I hope that's okay.
Oh, yeah, that's no problem.
So, okay, so let's start with you. Can you tell me more about you, your design background, what got you into it, and what are the what some of the things that you've worked on in the past?
So I've actually been practicing design professionally for about 15 years. I graduated in 1994 from Kendall College of Art and Design in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, worked a number of different kinds of design jobs and different kinds of design environments. So, you know, worked at several different consultancies, worked in the corporate environment, and then obviously when I was consulting, I went to work for Zeba Design here in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that was a big move up for me, because I joined them in about 1999, and at that time, they were really starting to get pretty big and doing a lot more strategy work and doing work for, you know, very high-profile clients. And that was at a level where we were doing projects at a strategic level that would affect the, you know, the company's output for years to come. I mean, there are projects that I worked on there that are still coming out the door. Like at Whirlpool, we did a massive strategic project for them, and they're still making stuff based on what we did for them 10 years ago.
Mm.
So that was quite an eye-opener, because I hadn't really done, you know, hardcore strategic work like that until I got there. And so that was an eye-opener, and that really, I think, helped round out my tactical skills of just making, you know, one thing for one client for an immediate market need that would be refreshed like a year later, which is, you know, kind of how it usually is for most designers. But that was a great experience. But I think, you know, after doing that and then working for some other design firms here in Portland, I finally felt like I needed to do my own thing, because there are things that you can't do when you have, you know, a layer of management in between you and the client.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're working for somebody else, you know, they've got their own ideas about what the direction of the company is and what the output of the firm is going to be and what they're going to show to the client. And I felt like I wanted to, you know, offer my clients a different perspective, or a different viewpoint, or bring my own viewpoint to the table.
Mm.
So in order to do that, you got to go out on your own. You can't really work for somebody else and try to force your point of view down their throat. It's just not going to happen, right?
Right.
So that was kind of the impetus for me to go out on my own, do my own thing, develop my own roster of clients, and obviously, you know, try to provide my clients with a different point of view, which, you know, hopefully helps them find opportunities in the marketplace for them to sell more products, which is really what it's all about. So I've been doing that for about 4 years, and, you know, obviously Yakima was actually one of my keystone clients when I first started.
Mm-hmm.
And I know those guys pretty well, because I had worked together with a couple of those guys before at other companies. When I went on my own, there was a great opportunity, a great matchup. When they were starting to develop new products, I had just opened my business, and they're like, "Hey, let's get together and collaborate and see what we can turn out."
And your company is called James Owen Design.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're based out of Portland, Oregon.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
When is the design industry in Portland pretty big? Because I've noticed a lot of people from up there, and a lot of big companies are in the northwest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Portland is interesting because there's actually a disproportionate number of creative people in this area. And I'm not really sure that there's enough companies to support that yet. So what you get is a lot of people who are doing you know, either startup or boutique companies, like, for example, small bike building companies, right?
Right.
That do a couple thousand bikes per year. That's kind of hot right now. And there's a couple of small, fashion companies here, that are making, you know, small limited runs of clothing lines, like Seaplane is probably the most famous of all those. And there's some smaller, like, footwear companies, and some failed footwear companies that tried to come here and just couldn't make it, that tried to, like, leverage, you know, Nike and Adidas talent and just couldn't make it last. So, but what you find is that a lot of people are attracted to this area. A lot of creative people are attracted because of the lifestyle, and because there's creative people. So it kind of feeds on itself.
Yeah.
And I think that's why design is really starting to take off here, is because that there's already a lot of design here, and there's more designers moving here because they heard it's great. Unfortunately, I just don't think there's enough jobs to support all those people yet. But right. That means that, you know, a lot of them are becoming entrepreneurs, which is great, which is a bonus.
Right.
But I think, you know, in the long view, I think it's going to grow. And again, I think the more publicity that this area gets, about there being good design here, you know, the hope is that it's going to attract, more companies to investigate the talent that's here.
Right.
And give, you know, Portland and the Northwest a little bit better chance at competing with, you know, the big firms in New York and LA and Chicago and so forth. So, and those are really, you know, the only other big areas with a lot of design.
Right.
Are those really big cities. But if you're looking for a balanced lifestyle and you want to be creative, you know, Portland's not a bad place to set up shop.
Right. And then, but to you though, you have such a diverse portfolio, and you've got stuff for shoes, you've got stuff for electronics manufacturers, you've got stuff for bikes like Yakima. Is there a particular thing that you like to design, or you sort of like to explore all the different options out there?
Well, the main reason that I did, you know, decide to start my own consultancy is because I got tired of doing the same thing over and over again.
Right.
And I first experienced that when I worked for Sharp Electronics for about 3.5 years back in the 90s. And they had a design center here in the U.S., and I worked there. But unfortunately, that design center was tasked mostly doing televisions and microwave ovens. And that's fun for maybe the first year or so.
Right.
But, you know, after a couple of years, you start getting burned out because it's the same thing over and over. And unfortunately, you know, this is true in most companies. You're not redesigning the entire product, you know, like the entire microwave. You're
right.
Reskinning it. You know, you're doing a refresh, right? Which is true. That's how companies operate. That's how they make money. They can't do new configurations and reinvent the product every year. It's just not economically feasible. That's the reality. That's fine. But unfortunately for the designer, either you just suck it up and you keep doing it, or you have to do something else. And I hung in there for a while because there were other opportunities that were great while I was there, and the people that I worked with there were awesome. And I learned a lot, but I just couldn't do any more microwaves, so I left. And even at consultancies, though, another pitfall is that, you know, let's say you get a keystone client that comes to your company, and they get very comfortable with working with one team or one person. And, you know, the way that sometimes the consultancy can look at it is, hey, we've got to keep this client happy, so we're going to keep this person on that account until the client leaves or gets sick of us. So that one designer kind of gets caught in the same trap of doing the same projects over and over again. That's what happened with me at another consultancy here called Fiori, that we had a big client, they were a great client. Again, fantastic to work with, but after doing 13 printers, you just can't do anymore.
Right.
I cannot look at another printer. And because you get, I mean, for a creative person, you get kind of, you can get burned out and you can get blinders, and that affects, that starts affecting your creativity. And right. if you jump onto another project, then you know, how good is your service really going to be for that new client that is not making printers, they're making something else. So how effective can you be for them? So I think that's, I got kind of nervous about that, and I don't think that's healthy.
Right.
So I felt like, you know, in order to stay on top of my game and to expand my horizons and keep myself refreshed, also explore new kinds of products and to discover new ways of doing things, because, you know, I learn from my clients as well as delivering solutions to my clients. I mean, I always learn something from my clients. It's not a one-way street. I'm not going to come in there and dictate what has to be done. I want to offer great product design solutions, but I always end up learning from them. And that's what's great about trying to work in as many different kind of product categories as possible, is that you end up learning new things that you didn't know before, and sometimes those kind of cross-pollinate. I mean, there's been times when I learned something, you know, with one client, say in a production process, and in a totally different category, totally non-competitive category, I was able to apply that same process or methodology. And that's fantastic, because that only keeps things fresh for everybody. That kind of helps everybody.
Yeah. Now, that, I'm just curious, since you brought that up, about you sort of, you're on your own now, you make things you want to make. You don't really want to make the same things over and over again. Is your home filled with just amazing prototypes?
No, the client keeps all the prototypes.
Right. But you don't make anything for yourself?
Not really. I mean, the thing is that any kind of prototype or exploration model that you do, that's the property of the client.
Right.
They end up keeping that.
Right.
And there's very little of the client's stuff that I keep. And, I mean, my office would be full of stuff. I mean, it would just be stacked to the rafters if I kept everything.
Right.
And frankly, I don't want to keep all that stuff, because it's stuff that helped us get to the final product solution that ended up on the shelf.
Right.
But that's really was its only purpose. And beyond that, it's not really useful. That's my point of view.
I hear you
know, one of my favorite designers is Luigi Colani.
Uh-huh.
But and I've read all of his books, and I've seen his office, and it's full of all these models that he's made over the years, right? It's just packed with all these models that he made.
Right.
And that's awesome. It's incredible. But I can't live like that. I can't have my office just be full of stuff. I'd go nutty. I tend to not really keep any of that stuff. I've got photo documentation of everything we've done in the project, because I think that's just, you know, a good way to do it. You've got to document and back up everything that you've done for the client, just in case something comes up in the future and they need reference and they don't have reference, you got it.
Mm.
But, you know, any prototypes that we do belong to the client. Because they kind of need them for evaluation and to show to other stakeholders that have decision-making authority on a program. And also, I actually don't want it. The only prototype really that I have is that cat scratching post, and that was kind of a special situation that is different than how I work on most projects.
That's a good one to have.
Yeah, I think that was probably why it was a special case. But, you know, for the most part, I wouldn't want to have, I really wouldn't want to keep most prototypes, because they're kind of awful. I mean, they work well. They prove functionality, and they're kind of proof of concept.
Right.
But unfortunately, they're not really useful beyond that. I mean, most prototypes are pretty bad. They're not really entertaining to look at.
Right.
It's not something you'd want to show around. So to me, that kind of stuff, I don't get that thrilled about. I kind of, like, want to move on, and I want to see the final production piece That's what I'm really excited about is seeing that thing on the shelf. And everything in between, after we finish, it's kind of like, okay, well, let's recycle that. Or, you know, if maybe you can do something else with it, that's great. But I actually don't get that jazzed about all the prototype stuff. I know a lot of people do like to keep that stuff and hang on to it, but I don't do it. I just don't like it.
Okay, so that leads me to a question still about you. Does that mean, okay, well, how would you describe your design aesthetic? Because you're not a minimalist. You're not, I don't know, it's one thing, I think everyone always wants to, like, categorize all the designers out there. So if we had to label you, what would we label you?
Well, I don't know. I've thought about that over the years, and I've tried to put a label on myself, but it just doesn't work. I'm not Karim Rashid, and I'm not Philippe Starck, and I don't think I'm ever going to be those guys, right? It's just like those guys are super famous, and they have a certain style, especially Karim Rashid. I mean, he's obviously got a very significant and iconic style.
Yeah.
And if anybody tries to copy that, it's going to look like you're copying Karim Rashid.
Right.
Or, you know, Mark Newson. He's got a very identifiable, iconic style.
Right.
And it's just, you know, he has great solutions for things, and I love what he does, but, you know, I wouldn't feel good about trying to directly copy everything that he does. I wouldn't try to find a Mark Newson approach for a product design.
How important is that? Because a lot of our readers are design students. So how important do you think it is for a designer to find their own sort of unique design aesthetic?
Well, that's a tricky issue because it's a very fine line. And I would suggest that to any student, you know, obviously, you don't want to copy exactly what somebody's done, but I don't think there's an issue with being influenced by designers, right?
Right.
Because Mark Newson and Karim Rashid and Philippe Starck and Isa Bursal and all these other great designers, both male and female, have plenty to teach us, you know, as younger designers. I mean, you know, I'm not at those guys' level at all, but there's stuff that I can learn from them and that I can apply to my own sensibilities and process. Like even Konstantin Gerchik, I think he's a great designer, and he actually probably fits more of what I like because he does things that are very angular but are still minimal to a degree,
right.
But are more sophisticated than, say, what Mark Newson does. When I say sophisticated, I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that he tends to use a little bit more. Mark Newson tries to reduce as much as possible, which is fantastic. I love that.
Right.
But Konstantin Gerchik tends to add a few more pieces to what he does, like the Myura bar stool is really awesome. It's a great-looking piece, and I like that. I think that fits more of how I would do something. But, again, I'm not him, and I'm never going to design like him. So I'm not going to try to do that. I'm not going to attempt to design like him. I can take influence from that and say, hey, that's cool. I like how he does things that are more angular, more severe, more aggressive, and more masculine. And I can absorb that as a philosophy,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not going to try to copy it. That's ineffective. It's not that it's legal or illegal. It's just that it's ineffective. You're not going to be that person. Don't try to be that person. My suggestion to design students or young designers is be yourself and be true to yourself and refine your style and your sensibilities, and that gets you much farther because it allows you to be flexible, and not every project will allow you to express fully your own design sensibilities. There are many times, especially when you work for a corporation or even a big design firm, where you have to design within a certain style because so many companies now have these design strategies, and this kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier. You know, at Ziba Design, I worked on several design strategy programs.
Mm-hmm.
And those design strategy programs were meant to feed design groups within companies. So they kind of had to work within this style guide or design guide that we created for them. So those designers have to, take that design guide in and then kick out a great design working within these rules and constraints that we set up for them. So kind of, it all kind of goes around. I've done that myself. I've actually worked under, design guides created by other firms, right? Mm-hmm. But it's how you interpret it and how you can come up with the best solution for that particular design problem within those guidelines. And if you understand that and you're comfortable with your own point of view, you can still get a great result that meets the design guide criteria, meets the product design brief, and makes the client happy, but you also feel good about.
Gotcha. Good, great advice. You still, what about your aesthetic, though?
So, I don't try to stick to any one particular style necessarily. I do kind of, in most cases, I do kind of, err more to the minimal side of things.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't call it subtle, but it tends to be more minimal.
Mm-hmm.
I try to keep things as simple as possible because I find that the simpler and more iconic a design is, the longer it's going to last and the greater impact it has on the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And on people in general, because iconic products tend to, I guess the basic way to say it would be, it tends to stick in your mind. I mean, when you see something by, again, Mark Newson or Karen Rashid, they tend to have very simple, bold silhouettes, and those things tend to stay in your mind. And just like the cat scratching post, that's something that is very simple. It's got a very simple outline.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to stick in people's minds more than something really complicated.
Right.
So I try to reduce and simplify as much as possible. It's not always possible to do that because sometimes the product has such constraints that you can't really do that. So you just try to reduce as much as you can, but sometimes you're stuck with something that's got a lot of parts, it's got a lot of plumbing, it has lots of articulation,
mm-hmm.
and there's just no way around it. It's just it has to be what it is, right? You can't put a big cowling over it because that's just not going to work.
Like the Yakima products. That's something that you probably couldn't reduce to a minimal point.
Oh, which is what? I'm sorry, I missed that.
The Yakima products?
Yeah, so there's, that's a good example because Yakima, they have lots of functional and mechanical constraints. And, in some cases, you don't want to add a lot to those anyway, because there's already so much going on because they have moving parts and they've got to, either hold bikes or hold stuff. And they've got attachment points and articulation points and areas that swing around other areas or fold out and open into something else.
Mm-hmm.
So really there, what you want to do is you just want to try to refine each part as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And try to bring everything together as one, but you don't want to overdo it so that it looks like you've just tried to put a big cowl or cowling over everything. And I hate that. I hate seeing that. Is when somebody tries to cover up too much of the machinery. You have to do that in some cases, but in other cases you don't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always kind of a balance with those, more complicated products. It's like a motorcycle where a motorcycle has lots of parts. And sometimes you see a motorcycle that has, it's all cowled and all fared and you can't see anything underneath. And then sometimes there's bikes that really have very minimal cowling. And you see most of the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes seeing most of the machine can be more interesting than seeing something that's very sleek.
I agree. Yes.
But again, that's not a hard and fast rule. And I hate to see people get caught in that trap of...
I was just going to say, I paused for a second because I was thinking, is that something that would apply to every product? No. But yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's very much a gray area, and I think that's a philosophical... that's my philosophical preference that there are certain guidelines, but they're not hard and fast rules because they can't be, because every product is different and you have to treat it differently and you have to treat it within its context and understand, you know, where it lives and where it's going to live and, you know, what it will be next to or be inside of or what have you. So it's all always about context. And I'm always get really worried when people have hard and fast rules about design is or design isn't, because design is kind of everything. And it's very subjective. And even though objects have to meet certain functional criteria in many cases, there's also the subjective aspect of design, and people have different opinions about that. So, you know, if there are any design students or young designers listening out there, I would say, you know, try not to become too rigid, because right. I think flexibility is what helps you win the race.
Right. So let's talk Yakima QuickBack. For the readers, the Yakima QuickBack is it's a bike mount for your car's trunk, and it uses straps to mount itself as opposed to being bolted into the roof or something. So James and Yakima were kind enough to send me one for review, and I finally have it mounted on my car. And I have a Toyota Prius. What threw me off about it, James, was I think when I was looking at the photos, I was looking more of sort of SUV-type vehicles. And the Prius is a hatchback. So I wasn't quite sure I had it mounted correctly, but I tried it, I tested it, it's super tight, it's not going anywhere. So can you tell me, and I know you, it's just one of four products you designed for them, right? For the series?
Yeah, so, and there's actually some more stuff coming out. They came out at Interbike, and it'll be coming out probably in January to the market. Okay. And obviously, there's many more products that I've done for them that didn't get released, you know, for various marketing or budgetary reasons. But these more recent ones, including the QuickBack, you know, fortunately have made it onto market. And I think the QuickBack's kind of made a splash because it is different from most of the, you know, typical bike racks that actually are A-frame shape and fold.
What was the decision behind that design difference? Because I was looking at a lot of other bike racks and they look completely different. All the other ones look similar. The QuickBack looks completely different. So what was the design decision behind that?
Well, so again, that's a great question because the QuickBack, what it comes down to is that there was a lot of research done into why existing bike racks are kind of hard to use, and they have a lot of straps, and getting them mounted is kind of a pain, and you have to set it and then put your bikes on, but it may not be correct. Then you got to take your bikes off and set it again, put your bikes back on and see if it fits and works. And even if you're going down the road, there might still be a problem. So you have to unhook it, reset it, and strap it all up. So there was a lot of research that was done around the functionality of current bike racks, interviewing the owners of those bike racks and people who own either Yakima bike racks or other brands, mm-hmm. and saying, how could we improve this? How could we make this better? What is the biggest issue with the current level of bike racks on the market? And the biggest one was just fit and the time it takes to get the rack on the car and adjustability.
How long is it supposed to take? Like normally, how long is it supposed to take?
Well, it depends and it varies. And it varies by the user and also the kind of rack that you've got. Right. And how familiar you are with it.
So let's say the QuickBack. The QuickBack, mm-hmm. you follow all the instructions, you're first time owner. How long would you say that whole install process should take? Or shouldn't take any time?
Well, ideally, you should be able to get that on your car within 5 minutes or less.
Okay.
And the reason we say that is because all the we've tried to reduce the amount of straps that have gone to the car. So we've gone from 8 to 6. We've also labeled all the straps that say top, middle, and bottom.
Right.
And we've tried to place them strategically on the product so that it makes sense where they're supposed to go.
Right.
And that also leads back to the adjustability of the rack itself. So it's not a scissor frame like most racks. It's actually an arc, and it's a telescoping arc. So the top tubes telescope out of the main body, and that provides – so you can set it on the car. You can adjust that quickly, tighten it down, and then the arms that hold the bike flip out, and you can adjust those, put those in place, and then put all the straps on, and you're done. So really – it should be a very quick process. And really all the user needs to do is just be cognizant of, you know, which straps go on top, which go on the side, and which go on the bottom. So it's just a simple matter of putting the top straps on, setting the rack on the car, you know, while you secure the top straps, adjusting everything, putting the other set of straps on, and you should be ready to go.
Right. I actually have a compliment for you and Yakima, because I installed the rack, well, I installed it once, almost a month ago, and I knew I installed it wrong, I just kind of left it there, and then I took it apart, or I took it off the car, and I installed it correctly, and I think it was last Friday, that I was driving around at the grocery store or whatever, I don't have a bike on it, it was just the rack itself, and somebody pulled up next to me at a stoplight and asked me about the rack, because he said from the side, he didn't know what it was from the back since I didn't have any racks on it. And then from the side, he still didn't know what it was because it was an arc. And I told him it was a bike rack. And he asked me all these questions about, does it function? Does it work? And I'm like, well, as far as I know, it works mounting on my car. I don't have a bike yet to try it. So I felt like an idiot telling him that. But the compliment was that he thought it looked a whole lot better than the bike rack that he had, which... In my opinion, I agreed with him. His bike rack looked kind of like two metal. I don't know how you describe it. Like a sort of an inverted A that had these giant pads that kind of rested on the glass of his window, rear window, and then one right by the bumper. And then he had all these straps going around them.
Yeah, and, I think I know which one you're talking about. That actually may have been one of the racks that we benchmarked our rack against, because some of the big complaints is that there are racks out there that are very popular, but they are so incredibly hard to set up that nobody takes them off their car. Once they get them set up, they're on the car permanently, and we didn't want that because really Yakima's philosophy is that they want to provide the customer with the most flexible gear possible. And when gear is really hard to use and set up, what happens is the customer ends up leaving it on their vehicle permanently because it's such a pain that they don't want to take it off.
Right.
Unfortunately, that means more weight, worse gas mileage, you know, inefficiency. If it's on top of a truck, and let's say they've got a bike on their rack and they forget it's up there, then, you know, they might do damage to their garage or their bike. So, you know, moving forward, Yakima is definitely trying to create products that are simpler, easier, and, you know, more obvious for the customer. So what does that mean for the design? Well, that means simplifying the design both visually and functionally.
Mm-hmm.
And so the arc was part of that. It looks very simple. And many of the racks we benchmark against, including some existing Yakima racks, was that they were very complicated looking.
Mm-hmm.
And one rack from a competitor in particular, which was designed by a famous designer who they profile on their website, is probably one of the worst products I've ever used in my life because it's a metal aluminum tube in the center.
Well, James, now that you say that, you have to tell us who the designer was and who the manufacturer is.
I don't remember who the designer was. He's an Italian guy, and I can't remember his name, but he's featured on this other bike manufacturer's website and as a big deal, right? He does all their products.
Right.
And they really make a big deal out of it. Unfortunately, the product he designed for them is so difficult to use that I think the consumer gets duped into buying it because it's kind of cool looking.
Yeah.
But once you get it home and you start setting it up, it is a nightmare. I've never used something so counterintuitive in my life. It's got a, you know, extruded metal tube in the middle, and then it's got three legs on each side that are around this tube, but you can't adjust the legs independently. And you have to, like, take the legs completely off the tube, readjust it, put it back on your car. If it doesn't fit, you start all over again. And that goes for both sides.
Wow.
And there are just straps all over this thing, and the straps have nowhere to go, so you end up storing them in the tube. But then sometimes they fall out of the tube. It's a disaster. It's a horrible product. So, you know, looking at that as, like, an extreme example of counterintuitiveness and poor functionality, we just decided that, look, we need to try to simplify and help the consumer while trying to design something that looks cool for that market, which is usually cycling enthusiasts or, you know, casual cyclists, but they don't want to put something hideous on their car.
Right.
And simplify it. Make it simple looking. And again, iconic, that comes up because of the simple C shape is very iconic. Because it's very simple. So we were able to reduce the complexity of the product by, you know, making it adjustable in a telescoping fashion, reducing the amount of straps, labeling the straps, and then also on the straps, we have strap clips so that you can gather up all this extra strappage and, you know, clip it to itself. So
which
that
I love. I love that because on the guy's bike rack, what he had done with the extra strap was he just sort of wound it around one of the bars. You know what I mean?
Right.
And yep, so, exactly. the little strap clips are perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and those, even those little functional improvements are huge to usability and customer perception of quality and functionality. And it's just unbelievable that so many companies that make bike racks haven't done that before. And, you know, I understand there are bike racks that are at a price point where you can't afford to do that, but there are many bike racks that they can afford to do that, and they're not doing it. They're not helping the consumer
right.
To clean up the look and be more functional and be easier to use. And actually, if it came down to it, that bike rack would still work even if you only had the top two straps on it. I wouldn't recommend it. You should have all six straps securing the rack onto the car.
Right.
But it will still work even if you only have the top two straps on the car because of the way it's designed. So I think it's a robust piece. And right. One of the key words that Yakima uses as a strategic driver for their product design is called bomber. And bomber is like this, you know, regional word for stout and indestructible gear that's not going to break.
Really?
And Yakima's
okay.
They're all about being bomber. It's like, hey, does that look bomber? No, that's not bomber. That's just not going to make it. So we need to do something in the design that's going to make it bomber, right? Because that's what the customers expect. They expect bomber equipment. And that does work because I still see 20-year-old Yakima racks and cargo boxes on top of old beat-up Subarus that people are still using. They're still using these things. So that's one thing that they've done that's a philosophy that guides their product development all the way through to the end. And I think that on the Quickback, you know, we kept that bomber ideal, which is a bit oversized, a bit over-engineered, but it's over-engineered so that it lasts. I mean, that bike rack is going to be around for a long time.
Right. So, and I will let the readers know that installation was quick. It was easy. Your hands don't get dirty. As long as your car is clean, and taking it off is easy too. And then with the little arm that can fold down, it's really small. You can like store it really easily when you're not using it. So
yep.
Do you remember how much Yakima is retailing it for?
Yeah. You know, I actually think that I think it was $139, $149. I'd have to go back and check the website. I actually haven't looked at actual street prices lately.
Right.
Because I've actually got a rack right now, so I haven't had the chance to upgrade because I feel guilty about buying something new when my current rack still works.
Right.
So I'm kind of on the fence. I'm like, oh, I should buy a new rack, but I feel guilty because I'll be, you know, it's kind of like, you know, maybe consuming a little bit too much. But
yeah,
I haven't checked the street prices yet, but I think it's fairly reasonable for what it does.
Yeah, 100 something is totally reasonable, and the Quickback holds three bikes, right?
You can get two or three bike versions.
But the maximum is three.
The maximum is three. That's correct.
Okay. Now.
Yep.
Here's a question. Now, it may sound like a stupid question. Obviously, you guys have already engineered and thought about this. Yes, your answer is probably yes, it is strong enough. But in my mind, and in a lot of people's minds, the idea of straps holding up potentially an expensive bike or bikes, are those six straps really going to hold it there for a long, long time through robust use? And I mean, I know your answer is going to be yes, but can you talk to me a little bit about that? Because just for reassurance.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great question. And everybody questions that all the time. And obviously, Yakima does exhaustive testing with bikes and overloading bike racks on their test rigs.
Yeah.
So actually at Yakima's facility, they have test rigs where they put their cargo boxes and rooftop top racks and rear of car racks and bike racks and they actually overload the racks. They put bikes on them, plus they put like free weights on them as well. And then they vibrate them, or they put them on a test car and they drive them around, over speed bumps, whatever, to see if they can try to shake it off and then see where the weaknesses are.
Yeah.
And that's actually part of the prototyping process, like we were talking about earlier. There's a lot of ugly prototypes that are structurally sound that are used specifically for that purpose, to see where they're going to fail.
Right.
Once they find out that they're going to where they're going to fail, then they beef up or bomberize that area. And it's usually not the straps. Usually, almost never are the straps are what the straps do. The straps fail because the straps are like a woven nylon, and those straps are pretty beefy. And usually, again, it's not the straps. It's either where the straps are connected to the piece, or it's the piece itself. So the straps, you can be rest assured, are probably the strongest link in the chain.
Oh, really? Okay, it's good to know.
Yeah, the straps are at this point, straps have been used on bike racks for over 30 years. Those nylon straps.
Yeah.
So they've got it pretty well dialed in. The makeup of the strap and the weave of the strap and the kind of material that's used in the strap. The straps are almost commoditized now, and they've gotten to the point where the straps are kind of universal.
Right.
And they know how much weight that the straps can hold, and it's so much more than you're ever going to put on those racks. There's just no way you could load up that rack with enough weight to break those straps. There's no way you could do it. You'd have to put some motorcycles on those things. And again, the arms on the rack would fail before the straps would.
Right.
If you loaded that, up with that much weight. There's just no way to do it. There's no way you can load it up.
Right. I love the rack. I mean, I can't wait. I put, the bikes I do have on there just to try it out. But I'm really waiting for the really nice bikes from Renovo.
Yeah.
And once I do, when I do get that, they promised me. So once I do get it, I will photograph it and I will send them to you and Yakima. And actually, James, I actually have a little surprise for you, but I'll tell you, after the call. But anyways.
Okay. Sure.
So the QuickBack and the other products you did for Yakima, the most recent product, you did those last year, right?
Well, yeah, that actually started back in 2007. So they've got a fairly long lead time on their products.
Yeah.
So there are things that, we started working on way back in 2007, early 2007 to late 2007.
Right.
And it's just, again, it's about their development process. They're not, they've obviously got market dates that they need to meet. They've got schedules, but those schedules aren't forced in such a way that would compromise the product. So they always want to have enough time to do the proper amount of testing, the proper amount of engineering and re-engineering, if that's what it takes. Because you never know what you're going to get, because many times Yakima is kind of, they actually do a lot of reinventing of different product categories or inventing new product categories. So they actually kind of come up with new configurations of products, which surprises me. I've actually not worked with a company that comes up with as many new kinds of products as they do. And some of them don't see the light of day, but many of them do. So they've got to have extra time in the schedule to make sure that those products not only function right, but are durable, are designed well, and you know, meet the criteria that is expected of that market. So their development durations tend to be just a little bit longer than, say, like consumer electronics duration, which can be really fast. You know, it can be 6 months in consumer electronics. You know, Yakima can take sometimes a little bit over a year to do something.
Right.
But that's because it's very mechanical. They do a ton of testing. And if it's not right, then they have no problem delaying it to make it right. Because what they don't want is, you know, somebody's bike falling off.
Oh, my God, that would be the worst thing to happen, yeah.
That'd be horrible. Yeah, that'd be horrible. So they definitely take the time to make sure that they're putting something out there that's a great quality product. And that's why the lead times are a little bit longer, which is frustrating as a designer because you want to see your product out there as soon as possible. But, you know, in this particular case, you know, it can be dangerous if these aren't done right. And they're doing them right because they're taking the time to do it right.
So, okay, James, I've got two more questions for you. I know I've kept you on the phone for over an hour now. I'm sorry.
No worries. It's Friday. No problem.
So my first question is, can you talk to me about some stuff you're working on now? Tell me a little bit about them or it. Maybe it's a secret. Maybe it's work in progress. Who it's for.
Okay, well, so the first thing I can say is that we are still working on the cat scratching post.
And okay.
At this point, it is, you know, our own effort in conjunction with two possible manufacturers in Europe. So, you know, we've signed some licensing agreements, preliminary licensing agreements, mm-hmm. and we're still working on refining the design for production.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, I cannot assign a date when it will be on the market, but we are still working on that.
Okay.
This is almost a 4-year odyssey now. but, you know, other stuff that we're working on, as far as, you know, continual client work, there's some Nike stuff in the pipeline, that we're working on, some packaging stuff for Nike, including some like eyewear accessories, which could be pretty exciting. Because it's for a group that's doing products that help improve athletic performance, which is great. So it's not really just styling on its own. It's actually accessories for products that help athletes become better athletes. And there's also some products that we did last year around that we're still investigating with them, you know, if we can get them to market. And I'm hoping to be able to publish those sometime next year. And that's all exciting stuff because anytime a designer gets a chance to go beyond just styling something to actually create a product that helps improve athletes' performance or improve somebody's performance, that's really exciting for me as a designer. And I would think it's exciting for most designers because it's going beyond just making a new version of something that already exists. This actually is going to help somebody become a better athlete. And I find that really exciting. So that's some stuff we're working on. And some other stuff is some high-end commercial-grade audio equipment for a company here in town, in Portland, actually, that they need a lot of help in their commercial-grade equipment. And this is stuff that goes mostly in, like, convention centers, hotels, boardrooms, that sort of thing. So it's you know, wall controller units that control digital audio processors that are in back room. But all these units go together, so what they needed help with was the strategic side of things. So, again, it's back to, you know, creating strategic design guidelines that actually we'll be implementing. So we're creating guidelines for them that we're going to end up implementing ourselves, which is actually the best position to be in.
Oh, yeah, that's but exciting.
The great thing about them is that they really didn't have much grasp of how effective design can be. And the design they'd done in the past was kind of done by the engineers inside the company.
Right.
So, you know, it took some some training on our side to help them get on the right track, really help them understand what robust product development's all about and what it really takes to, you know, implement not only design, but a little bit of research and, you know, outside engineering to get something on the market that was far above anything they had done in the past.
Right.
So that's been a little bit of a different case where somebody like Nike already knows what design's all about.
Right.
You know, this company needs lots of help just to understand the power of design and what it could do for them and what is product development and what does it take to get a wall controller onto the market. What's the effort required there? So that's interesting because you're not only, you know, designing something for a client, you're kind of educating them as you go along. And that can, you know, it has its ups and downs, but ultimately it's great because then they just end up trusting you more.
Awesome. So, James, last question. What's your favorite color and why?
My favorite color.
Yes. And I know it seems like it may seem like a pointless question, but I've asked every single designer that I've interviewed or podcasted with, and I don't know why, but everyone always pauses. And I would think that's like, you know, I know what my favorite color is. So what's your favorite color?
Well, I'm going to have to qualify it by saying that my favorite color right now.
Okay.
my favorite color right now is probably magenta.
And it's, really? It's the, okay.
It's a hexachrome magenta in the Pantone book.
Okay. Why?
Because it's hugely bright and it's really obnoxious. It's just one of the most obnoxious colors you could think of. But I like it because if you use it sparingly, it just punches you in the face and it wakes you right up. And I love that. I just love that about the color.
I'm curious. Have you used it in anything?
I used it on some of my old branding.
Okay.
On the last revision of my website. Or 2 revs ago, I was using that color.
Yeah.
But I update the website, you know, a lot because, you know, we're always getting new work in. So I'll go in and update the website. You know, we kind of self-administer our website here. We're not big enough to be able to pay somebody yet to do that.
Right.
But I'll go in and I always tinker with it. I always change the color because I get bored. But the magenta, it seems like an extremely trendy color, and it is to a degree because it's so bright and so polarizing, but I still like it because it really is a weird color, but it when you see it, you can't not have an opinion about it. Either you hate it or you love it, and that's what I like about it. It's not like white, where it's like, I kind of like white, or, you know, black, yeah, I kind of like it. It's magenta. So you like it or you eat it.
James?
Yep.
I lost you for a second, just for a few seconds.
Okay.
But I just pulled out my Pantone books, and I'm going to... Would you say it was magenta, the hexachrome magenta color?
Yeah, it should be... and it may not say magenta. It should say magenta on it, but it's like one of the hexachromes. So it's probably in the front of the solid-coated book.
Hexachrome magenta C.
There you go.
That's a really bright color.
Exactly. It's brutal. It's not gonna, you know, it's not gonna let you get away with anything.
You know, if you ever make any products with this color, it would. I actually have seen one thing that's made from this color, and it's a phone. It was a very limited edition phone, and I swear it was a color like this or very similar. It was a Japanese mobile phone. And the entire case of the phone was this color, and the screen was one of those mirror reflectant LCD screens. But other than that, yeah, I don't really. My friend, if you can integrate this color into some products, I would love to see that.
Well, I mean, that would be a goal, but, you know, obviously there are very few clients out there who want to take that challenge on, and I think the Japanese are. That's probably one of the few countries where you'd get away with that.
Right. I remember this phone now, too. It was a phone for, I think, Docomo, and it was a Panasonic phone, or I don't want to misspeak. I think it was a Panasonic phone. It was a clamshell, and there was, like, 10 of them, and they were all bright, bright colors.
And yeah. So, yeah. Yep. Yeah, it's a cool color. Again, I think if you use it in the right way, it can be really cool. Obviously, it's used more in fashion design, and it's kind of on its way out, I think, trend-wise. But it always comes and goes. That's a color that's like, it comes and goes. And 10 years from now, it'll probably be back, you know,
yeah.
in style. Again, hardcore. But I think we're kind of going back into this, you know, darker, more subdued hue phase now.
Oh, really?
You know, well, right now, everything's really bright colors.
Yeah.
Everything's, like, super bright.
Right.
And I think, I don't know where you guys are, but I'm sure you've seen, you know, the neighborhood teenagers and everything's super bright. It's super bright green or
yes.
super bright
pink. The shoes, the colors, the accessories, everything is bright, yeah.
Yeah, all yellows and stuff like that. So I think probably the next phase is going to be, you know, going back to the darker, grungier colors, browns and ochres and that sort of thing. It would be probably the next so-called revolution.
Okay, I'm going to quote you on that. You guys heard it. James said
yeah.
he's going to go dark and subdued, muted. So thank you so much for taking out this whole hour and 15 minutes to speak with me. That's really long. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, no problem.
It was really exciting. Now I want the Scratch and Post more than ever. So I'm a little... my desire for it dulled a little bit when I found out it didn't wobble, but I still want it because it's a beautiful object. And also thanks to James and the Yakima for the quick back. And I will be posting a more proper review on the quick back in a separate post, not in this podcast, so all you guys can read that. So again, thanks, James.
Very, thank you.
Again, thanks to James Owen. You guys, make sure you hit up his website. It's www.jamesowendesigns.com. And until next time, bye, guys.